Hi, this is Leah.
And this is Layla. Welcome to Breast Cancer Unleashed. Everything you need to know about breast cancer, but are too embarrassed to ask. Where we unleash about ridiculous, hard-to-share subjects with top experts. Where nothing is out of bounds and every topic is appropriate. So today's episode is really going to be exciting. I mean, Leah, I never realized, you don't realize when you go through breast cancer, or you get diagnosed with breast cancer, that you're going to end up being on medication literally for years, depending on what your diagnosis is. And today we have an incredible guest who is going to be talking about all of the treatment after chemotherapy and radiation for women that are premenopausal, postmenopausal. We have Dr. Megan Cruz today. She is a breast medical oncologist and director of clinical breast cancer research at the Towson Cancer Institute of Cleveland Clinic. Woo! She received her MD from Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, and she completed hematology and a medical oncology fellowship at Cleveland Clinic, where she also served as chief fellow and was appointed to staff in 2017. So she really focuses on optimization of care for patients with lobular breast cancer, and she's a member of the NCI Breast Immuno-Oncology Task Force, NRG Oncology Breast Cancer Core Committee, and quite a few other committees as well. So she definitely knows her stuff. And Leah, you have a close relationship with her.
I do. Oh my gosh. Well, first of all, I guess I haven't read her bio. Holy shit, that was long.
It's a lot of stuff. I'm like, and there's more, but she's very involved.
So here's what's interesting. So October 2017, I was diagnosed, and I was already, my day job, when I actually get paid on, I was in the cancer world and actually very familiar with breast cancer physicians here in Cleveland. And I remember I was like, I knew in my mind who I wanted to go see in order of priority. And I wanted to start with the one that was the top in my mind. And when I called up and I had people like connecting me because I had connections, get me appointments, and they're like, well, yeah, your doctor's gonna be Megan Cruz. I'm like, wait, you mean the one who just finished her fellowship? Like, no, could I have someone else? Like, shame on me for thinking that, you know, fellowship, like they have already gone through extensive training. But in my mind, I was like, maybe someone who's had more attending training, like already seen their own patients. But sure enough, I was proved wrong. I kept Dr. Cruz. And as you will see here in this recording, she is absolutely fabulous. The way she, the time, the conversation you see is exactly the conversations I have in her office. So thoughtful, so calming, very nurturing, very, very reassuring, but also backed by data and science. So I think very highly of Megan Cruz because, quite frankly, she's kept me here alive on earth today and has minimized my side effects. I joke with my husband, there's very few people I ever want to piss off. It's, first, God. Second, my husband. Then next, my boss. And then, of course, my oncologist. Because either one of them could probably end my life like immediately or career. So in no particular order. Well, God first. But at any rate, she is very near and dear to my heart. So I say we kick it over to her and have her explain, if you are HR positive, what are all the ins and outs of oral therapies that you will need or have to consider when the time is right in your journey? Welcome, everyone. I'm excited today. This is going to be such a wonderful talk. So we have the honor and the privilege of having Dr. Megan Cruz join us today. Dr. Megan Cruz is a staff physician with the Cleveland Clinic Cancer, Towson Cancer Center here in Cleveland, Ohio. And she is a breast medical oncologist, as well as the director of the breast cancer research team at Cleveland Clinic. She has been on staff with the Cleveland Clinic since 2017. And I must say, from a personal side, she is my personal medical oncologist that she had just the privilege of meeting me in 2017.
Everybody has the privilege of meeting you.
Yeah. In October of 2017. So she probably didn't know what she was getting into, but she probably got a handful. But anyhow, thank you so much, Dr. Cruz, for joining us. We're so excited to have you here.
Thanks for having me. Yeah. And it's been an honor and a privilege to know you all these years, Leah.
And when a camera goes off, oh gosh, she drives me nuts. Stop the messages. The reason why we reached out to you, Dr. Cruz, you know, this is, I actually had a good friend of mine who hopefully is listening to this now, so it's educating her. She came to me and she said, okay, I'm HR positive and I am now presented with all these hormonal therapies, endocrine therapies, whatever the different words are for it. I don't know what to do. You go to Google which is the whole reason we have this podcast, so people are not going to Google. And you start looking up endocrine therapy, tamoxifen, aromatase inhibitors, and it's quite scary. It's trying to understand what is it that I need for where I am when I'm hormone receptor positive. And then, like, once I figure that out, what do I do to counter any possible side effects? Because as we've talked, there could be a lot of side effects that come up with AIs and endocrine therapies. So what I want to do on this call here is kind of let's break down and learn about all the ins and outs that happen for a patient, male or female, who is HR positive. And this can be at any point. This can be whether or not you've had surgery. Well, I mean, you've probably had a lumpectomy or double mastectomy, but it's regardless of any radiation therapy you may have had. Some patients may not even had chemo, or they're not going to have chemo. Maybe this is the only thing they'll have. But what we know that stands true is that if you are HR positive, at some point you'll likely have a form of endocrine therapy. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah, definitely. And that's actually where I usually start the conversation with my patients. You know, as a medical oncologist, when I look at their pathology report, that's a little bit like the roadmap for me about what medical treatment options we have. And so the estrogen receptor, progesterone receptor, HER2, those things really tell me yes or no. Is there a medicine that I need to provide for my patient that targets each one of these things? Because I think about those like the light switches. They cause the cancer to grow. And if they're not there or they're negative, they're not going to have any impact on whether or not that cancer grows. So we don't really need to worry about them. And for most of our patients with breast cancer, it's about 70%. They are hormone receptor positive, estrogen receptor and or progesterone receptor positive. So usually that's how I open the conversation, is saying at some point along the way, whether it's now or 6 months from now, some kind of anti-hormone treatment is going to be part of your plan. And then try to get into those details a little bit later down the line, because as you said, it's really like learning a whole second language once you start to get into all these terms and options.
There's so many different types out there. You just mentioned, right? 70% of patients will be on some sort of endocrine therapy, right? But 30% won't. Mm-hmm. I'd love to talk about the 30%, but first, for this 70%, let's talk about what some of these therapies are, because we hear tamoxifen, we hear there's commercials, Veozah, we hear, is it Keytruda is one. Mm-hmm. I mean, all of these commercials, and it's like for ER positive, HR positive, you know, it's very overwhelming.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And I think part of the first step in a patient's journey is figuring out, you know, which group, which tribe or bucket or however you want to describe it, do you fall into or belong to? You know, the hormone receptor positive piece is a challenge because even though this applies to most of our patients, the drugs that we use to treat this part of the breast cancer growth pattern, they've been around for a long time. I mean, we're talking decades. And so you're not going to find commercials for these agents. Most of them are generic. And so they're maybe not the flashiest or the sexiest part of therapy, but they are the foundation. And so it's really on us as medical oncologists to kind of set that stage for what the options are and, you know, what might be right for each individual patient. And I think a lot of that decision-making starts regarding menopausal status. So pre or postmenopausal. Okay. This is a huge piece of what I think about. And you'd think it would be easy to identify this for most women. However, it can be really challenging because some women don't have regular periods. Some have had hysterectomies, but they still have their ovaries. So they don't get periods, but they may or may not still have ovarian function where they're getting estrogen production in their body. And the reason that's so key is that we have these two general classes of medications. So I think about aromatase inhibitors, which you'll often hear are best for postmenopausal women. And in fact, they don't work for a premenopausal woman unless you make her postmenopausal. Mm-hmm. And then you have SERMs, S-E-R-M, or selective estrogen receptor modulators. And that's the group that tamoxifen falls into. There are other drugs in that group, but realistically for breast cancer treatment, tamoxifen is it for that. And that one you'll often hear about for premenopausal women. What's interesting is there's this bias that it's only used for premenopausal women, but actually it can be used for pre or postmenopausal women. And so we have to think about some other criteria that may or may not make a postmenopausal woman a better candidate for an aromatase inhibitor or tamoxifen. So you think about those two big categories. And then once you dive into aromatase inhibitors more, that's where you find anastrozole or Arimidex, letrozole or Femara, and exemestane or Aromacin. And those three drugs are all aromatase inhibitors. And so which one you pick within that group, it really doesn't matter. They're all doing the same thing. But sometimes that's even the confusion is like, wait, what? My doc talked to me about anastrozole. Is that its own category? And then they're talking about aromatase inhibitors. And sometimes us as doctors, we're not always the most aware of when we're switching those languages. You know, we live in both worlds. So are we using the brand name, the generic name, the drug group name? So that's another thing to think about is if you as a patient are not sure, just ask your doctor to step back and be like, okay, break that down for me. Which one of these drugs are we talking about? And are you using the generic or the brand name?
So let's start with a patient who may be, let's say she's premenopausal, if we can identify that. So a younger patient. I actually fell into that bucket. So I was diagnosed at 39 and I was still menstruating, had regular cycles. So, I mean, I knew very well I was not menopausal yet. So for the patient that we know, or at least you can figure out that they are premenopausal, what are their options?
So then we know that tamoxifen is kind of the go-to option for a woman who's premenopausal. But there sometimes is a situation in which we say, you know, maybe you need a little bit more than tamoxifen. And so then I'm starting to think about not just a patient's own sort of biologic characteristics related to their menopause and their ovarian function, but also the tumor-related characteristics. And so we know that if a patient has a really risky cancer, and that can be broken down in a number of ways, but in simple ways, think about it for those patients who may have a bunch of lymph nodes that are involved with their cancer, really big tumors, or sky high risk assessed on a different test, like maybe Oncotype or MammaPrint. Those may be patients where they need even more estrogen blockade than what tamoxifen can offer. And so we think about actually medically shutting down their ovaries with drugs like Lupron or Zoladex. These are drugs that in general shut down reproductive organ function. So you'll see them in fertility where you want to take over reproductive hormone function. They're also used for prostate cancer. Yeah. But in breast cancer, the goal is to take a premenopausal woman and make her postmenopausal so that we can then go ahead and give an aromatase inhibitor. So that's not going to be most premenopausal patients. Most premenopausal patients are going to get tamoxifen. And then over the course of their treatment journey, they may actually become postmenopausal and then naturally be candidates to switch to aromatase inhibitors.
So I'm going through the shit now. The minute that I had chemo, right, it put me right into menopause. The hot flashes started. I take Effexor now and I'm on tamoxifen. So am I hearing you correctly in that after I finish taking tamoxifen, how long does this crap last? That's number one. But number two, is there a possibility that after tamoxifen, after the typical 5 years that they say, you could be extended on tamoxifen or have something added in, or even just is it best practice to switch over to an aromatase inhibitor?
Yeah, that's a great question. And this is where there's a lot of data that backs up decisions, but it's also a lot of style and it's a lot of patient preference. And so the by the book answer is if a woman can get exposed or treated with an aromatase inhibitor at some point in their cancer journey, it's probably a good thing because we know that aromatase inhibitors, by the way they work, they actually decrease estrogen levels a little bit more than what tamoxifen does. And so we haven't really talked about this, but if you take a big step back, in simple terms, tamoxifen is really blocking the estrogen receptor. So no matter how much estrogen you have in your body, whether your ovaries are making it or you're getting it other ways, tamoxifen should be blocking where it acts. And so your body feels like there's not estrogen around, even when there is. And then aromatase inhibitors, they actually physically decrease the amount of estrogen that your body makes from your adrenal glands. So those little glands, they sit on top of your kidneys. When you're premenopausal, the amount that your adrenal glands make, it's tiny. It's like a drop in the bucket compared to what happens with your ovaries. But when you're postmenopausal, that's the only way your body gets estrogen. And so this is really why for a premenopausal woman, you can't give her an aromatase inhibitor and expect it to work because the ovaries are going to totally overwhelm that medication effect. So the fact that when you get an aromatase inhibitor, you're actually stopping production, that's a bigger estrogen loss for your body than if you're giving tamoxifen that's allowing some estrogen to stay in your body. And it really depends. You know, again, this kind of goes back to what a woman's starting risk is. You know, if the risk is really low, or you have other factors driving your cancer. So for example, a woman who has hormone receptor positive and HER2 positive cancer. For her, the HER2, and that's Leah, right? So the HER2 part of that is going to be the bigger driver of cancer growth. So you don't have to necessarily overdo it with the anti-estrogen piece. They kind of work together. But when you have estrogen as your main driver of breast cancer, typically you want to be as aggressive with that as possible. But aggressive also comes with side effect burden, as you're talking about. Yeah, and then time, you know, I think over time in medical oncology, we just keep wanting to do more, right? So in the old studies with tamoxifen, we knew that 2 years was better than one and 5 years was better than two. So then this question kept coming up, what if we go beyond five? We know with tamoxifen that there is a small survival advantage of going from 5 years to 10 years. With aromatase inhibitors, that piece of the story is not entirely clear. Most of the time beyond 5 years, what you're doing is preventing new breast cancers, not really treating the cancer that you originally had. And so normally that conversation, when I start it with patients, I say, let's plan for you to be on this for at least 5 years. And then that may morph into something more, depending on how they're tolerating it, what kind of complications we're causing in their body. And, you know, the data keeps changing. There's more studies that come out every year of women who are taking longer duration, shorter durations, and trying to figure out what is that like right size fits all approach. And the truth is, there is no one size fits all. It really is different for each patient. So it's a complicated answer because there's so many factors at play. But yeah, normally what you can bank on is the first 5 years are really the most important. Getting through that is the key period of time. And anything beyond 5 years in my mind, I pretty much consider bonus time.
In thinking about my therapy, one of the reasons why I had said, yeah, let's go with tamoxifen and not AI is, and I say AI with aromatase inhibitors. Personally, I wasn't prepared to go full shutdown, like full menopause overnight.
Yeah.
So when I had my babies, when I had my children, that second day, I went to like immediate postpartum depression and anxiety when my hormone levels crashed. So I say all this because I was frightened, and it was absolute disruption of the family and health of our family, the way I was in absence of those hormones, and especially when it happened overnight. That was a leading decision, one of the leading decisions in why I wanted to do tamoxifen, because I wanted to keep my body still producing estrogen and progesterone and keep the hormones going, but I wanted to be able to stop it. In my mind, it's like where it says it's a SERM, S-E-R-M, selective estrogen receptor modulator, right? Like it just blocked in my mind the estrogen from attacking the breasts and in key areas like maybe ovaries and such. Mm-hmm. But that was one of the reasons why I decided to go ahead with it, because I could still be producing and it wouldn't make me go into full menopause within like a day.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whereas some of the other options, and it was we move more into the other aromatase inhibitors, you either have to do the Lupron or the, what's the other one? It's Lupron and
Zoladex.
And that puts you into menopause. Now I say it's temporary because you can always stop taking the therapies, correct? Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. Hopefully your ovaries will start kicking back in and producing estrogen.
That's right.
There's also an option of doing surgery, a hysterectomy, which we can kind of move down the road if we want to do full shutdown while going on to an aromatase inhibitor. But I just wanted to add in that little tidbit that that's what helped drive my decision in leaning towards tamoxifen.
Yeah, I think that's hugely important. And when you're having conversations about starting these medications, I will often ask patients about experiences like that. Like, you know, times in their life when hormones have been at play, you know, around pregnancies, around their periods, if they've ever taken oral contraceptives, and how did that make them feel? Because some women will tell me, like, I could never take birth control. I knew when I was on those hormones or when I was coming off of those hormones, I felt terrible. Mm-hmm. And I remember you sharing with me what your postpartum period was like, you know, early on when we met. And I think as a medical oncologist, that's important for us to keep in mind, because if we have choices that might be a little bit more favorable to a patient's overall health, right? It's not just about keeping them breast cancer free, even though, you know, that's the main objective of my job. But I think it's also helping to guide in ways to keep you cancer free that are also compatible with the rest of your life, right? You go through cancer treatment because you want to live that life. If you're not living that life, maybe we're not succeeding on our goals. You know, some people also tell me like, yeah, when I am around my period, I get horrible migraines. Well, that's important for me to know because maybe once I start you on tamoxifen or, you know, Layla, to your point, once you get your chemotherapy, you come out of it, you're abruptly menopausal, you may feel really bad in different ways. And that may be permanent, may be temporary, but it may allow for some extra work on our part to help manage those side effects. So I think this is all important when you're getting to know a patient. Like part of taking their medical history is not just, oh, do you have hypertension? Do you have diabetes? But also these other pieces that are going to influence tolerability of what we recommend going forward.
So my side effects have been horrible. I mean, they have been really horrible. And I did fertility for a very long time, off and on. And I blame my cancer partly on that. I did fertility treatments and it was all unsuccessful. And my hot flashes, really, because of the effects, are, I don't have them every 45 minutes, but they are intense and really severe. And I'm like, is my body fighting to like go back to normal? I'm like, when is this going to end?
Let's kind of dive into that. So we've already identified that as more for premenopausal, but also can be during menopause or postmenopause.
You know, I think when you're thinking about estrogen loss and side effects, there's some classic categories of things that happen regardless of if you choose tamoxifen or an aromatase inhibitor. And it does seem like the more abruptly that transition happens for you, often the more intense it all is. So, you know, our patients who come out of chemo and all of a sudden are menopausal or do decide to have their ovaries out, and then the next, you know, within hours, they're menopausal, they often have very, very significant frequency and intensity of symptoms. And those can fall into some major categories like hot flashes, which go under this medical term, you'll hear of vasomotor symptoms. And so that's whether it's hot flashes, sweating, flushing, chills, like all of that kind of fits together. And it's really your body's inability to regulate its own temperature anymore.
Yeah, I get it.
Yeah.
It's constant. This is my third. I worked out, got dressed, changed again after I had a hot flash.
Wow.
Yeah, dear, and heavens, girl.
That's the thing. It can be maddening.
It's maddening.
So what can we do then? So let's talk about the side effects of tamoxifen.
Yeah.
Those common ones. And what are some of the things we can do about it?
Yeah. So I think for sure the hot flashes are going to impact people's lives significantly. And this is actually both for men and women. So, you know, men also take tamoxifen for hormone positive breast cancer, and they also will have a lot of side effects when they're on treatment. And so managing hot flashes is like part and parcel of what a medical oncologist does or should do. And I think it's a challenge because patients will all approach it differently in terms of what they want to do. And there's medical treatments that help with hot flashes, but then you're taking potentially a pill to treat the side effects of another pill, and people feel all sorts of ways about that. But I think if it's impacting your quality of life that significantly, and you know, a lot of times it's also impacting your sleep because hot flashes tend to happen at night, or it's there. Layla's experiencing that.
That's why I got on Effexor. Yeah. It took me 2 years. I didn't want to do it because I did not want to be on another medication. I was terrified. Yeah. I'm like, I'm already on this tamoxifen. I have to be on this crap for 5 years. I didn't want to take another one. My sleep, I was so exasperated that it got to the point of where I was like, okay, I'm going to try it. And it's been incredibly helpful, but it hasn't gotten rid of everything. It's still incredibly intense.
Yeah. And I think that's, everybody's got their own line of like, okay, if it happens at night, I'm willing to do one thing. If it happens during the day, or if it's impact, like if people at work are looking at me crazy because this is happening, you know, I've had teachers be like, I can't be having these symptoms in front of a group of teenagers because they are merciless, you know? So we got to know about it.
Those assholes. Asshole.
They are. They can be. So, you know, I think if you've mentioned Effexor, and that's one of our like hallmark medications. So Effexor or venlafaxine, it's an antidepressant by its nature, but it happens to have this off side effect, so I guess a good side effect, helping to manage hot flashes really by changing how sensitive your own nervous system is to these impulses that would make you have a hot flash. And, you know, sometimes you don't know what that is. It can just happen naturally. Other times people know their triggers, like caffeine, spicy food, wine. Again, a bunch of good things we love about life, but then don't want to cut them out entirely. So Effexor can be really helpful. It depends on the person. You know, some people who have already been treated for depression, anxiety may not be able to add a medication like this, or they may have some challenges with handling it because it can come with sometimes weight gain, which, you know, is another thing that we worry about with endocrine therapy. It can also come with suppression of sexual desire and sex drive, which is another issue with endocrine therapy. So these things all compound, you know, they're like all these little building blocks that add up. But on the flip side of that is if your hot flashes are so bad that you don't have much of a sex drive, that you don't want to go out and do anything anyway, it may be worth it to treat it.
And I was bald.
And you were bald. So your body image was maybe a little bit different anyway. You know, for some simple things with hot flashes, avoiding the triggers, if you can be helpful. Layering is key. You know, carry a sweater everywhere. Wear short sleeves when you can, even in the wintertime in Cleveland. And then some people have found that magnesium and vitamin E, which are just two supplements that don't have a lot of side effects on their own, can be really helpful. The scientific evidence behind it, not super strong, but I will tell you, I have patients who take magnesium at night and they're like, you know, it helps me just enough. Those are some good tips or tricks to try as you get started, especially if you're not ready to sign on for a prescription quite yet. And then there's also a medication that is an oldie but a goodie, Neurontin or Gabapentin. I don't know if you all have heard about this one. But it can also be another two for one because many patients coming out of chemo will have neuropathy or numbness and tingling of their fingertips and toes. And gabapentin is a good medication to help with that, but it also can help with hot flashes. So when I'm thinking about a prescription, I'm kind of thinking about where am I going to get the most bang for my buck? And if I can treat two side effects rather than one side effect, you know, that may be the road we go down. And then most recently, just like in the last 6 months, there's been approval for a non-hormonal, non-antidepressant medication called Veozah, or fezolinetant is its generic name. And this is a brand new category of medication that deals with hot flashes that actually doesn't have a lot of side effects at all. I mean, really, really low risks of things like nausea or diarrhea. We have to keep an eye on someone's liver function tests while they're on the medication, but very, very well tolerated and really helpful for both frequency and intensity of hot flashes. The challenge is because it's brand new, it's expensive. And so, you know, it's always this battle. There are some assistance programs through the company. I definitely encourage people to check out the website because you can get some help there. And if you've tried other medications and they don't work for you, it ups the chances that maybe your insurance will help you cover the Veozah. But that's been hugely helpful for a couple of my patients.
Good. Yeah. So that's the tamoxifen, right?
Yeah. Let me just ask real quick. Okay. So you mentioned magnesium, vitamin E, any certain doses? Like I was looking through my notes. I remember I saw recently a recommended dose for magnesium was 310 to 320. I mean, is it even possible to put a number around this? I mean, it's like, it just made me wonder, what am I actually taking? But if someone wanted to use it specifically for hot flashes at nighttime, is there a certain number that you say to shoot for or just...
Usually magnesium pills have come around 200 milligram tablets. And magnesium oxide was the one that a lot of people used to use. And now there's some newer data for magnesium glycinate, I believe. And that one, the glycinate has a little bit less risk of loosening up your bowels if you're somebody who has a little bit more irritable bowel. So 200 to 400 milligrams, which is essentially like one to two pills. And you can do that just at bedtime. You can also use it during the day. And, you know, two pills twice a day would be a very reasonable kind of upper end of that without hopefully giving you a lot of diarrhea, but also controlling things. And vitamin E is usually 400. That comes in international units rather than milligrams. Yeah. So 400 international units daily.
You're so polite. Awesome. It helps loosening up the bowels. In other words, someone who shits themselves often should not take a high dose of magnesium. Or I was actually thinking of my end, like, shit, I am so constipated now, like after chemo, like maybe I should pump up my magnesium to get regular because
Go buy that Natural Calm. That Natural Calm at Whole Foods. Just buy the Natural Calm. Don't drink too much of it because you will not be able to leave the house the next day.
Yes, yes. I have had patients accidentally buy like milk of magnesia, which is, you know, a good old constipation relief remedy rather than like the magnesium pills. And they're like, what did you recommend to me, Dr. Cruz? I'm like, no, that wasn't the intention. But magnesium's been awesome. Honestly, I've been so surprised. And it's one of those things that I don't think I was ever really taught other than, you know, replace it if it's low. But even if your levels are normal, it helps with all these things that can happen with anti-estrogen and chemo, like muscle cramps, sleep disturbance, headaches, like the list goes on and on. And
it's great.
Yeah. I've been so impressed. So I'm a total convert on that.
Yeah. Let's get into the aromatase inhibitors too.
Yeah. So what you just heard for tamoxifen can happen with aromatase inhibitors too. The aromatase inhibitors can give you a lot of hot flashes. It just so happens that because we use them in postmenopausal women who may be 20, 30 years from their own natural menopause, they just might be less likely to have hot flashes. But if you're on the younger end of that, like let's say you're in your 50s in postmenopausal, you might experience a lot of hot flashes. So all that same guidance applies.
I'm never going to see the end of these hot flashes. I mean, it's really ridiculous. I mean, I talk about it all the time. It's never
suck it up, like, woman.
Yeah. I'm serious. Sorry,
it gives you a glow. As long as we don't see a bead of sweat.
No, when I see beads of sweat. No, I'm oily. That's the glow.
Send all your dirty laundry to Leah to do it for when you're changing your clothes four times a day.
Listen, I hate to say it, but I will give the other side of it. This is not to brag, but you know, I have been on tamoxifen. I got through the first 2 months. It's been a placebo for me. I only share that because, you know, I don't want our listeners to think like tamoxifen is the hell, or I don't want to go on any of these. Yeah. Everyone will react differently and experience it differently. The first 2 months, I experienced what I called heat waves. I never broke down to sweat, like beads of sweat, but I could be somewhere like, whoa, like someone just turned up the temperature, about 10 seconds, gone. So that happened for about 2 months. And then all of a sudden I was like, God, I haven't had one forever. And I haven't had one since. So for me, tamoxifen since then has been a blessing. It's been a placebo for me, but it can also be the opposite end of the spectrum, like what Layla is saying. So it's,
yeah, it's so true. And this is, you know, that's the other key when you're starting to talk about it is most patients are going to fall in the middle where they've got like, you know, one or two side effects that are annoying, but not horrible. I would say it's like, probably 20% of patients who feel completely fine really don't notice any difference. And then, you know, 20 to 25% of patients who are like, this is truly impacting my quality of life, or it is so bad that I'm on the verge of saying, I can't do this anymore.
Yes.
That's where I was. Yeah.
And those are the really hard, because thankfully, like with some time and with some troubleshooting, we can often get it to be tolerable. But not always, or sometimes the steps that required it to be tolerable then are so large or so significant that you start to say, like, is this really worth it? And those are probably some of the toughest conversations that I have. Yeah. So aromatase inhibitors like tamoxifen can have, you know, these vasomotor hot flash effects. They can disrupt your sleep. They can also impact sex drive and metabolism and weight gain, which, by the way, in clinical studies, weight gain and weight loss are reported equally with these drugs. But I don't know who did those studies because I only ever hear about weight gain. So take that for what it's worth.
Well, and I will say that the only side effect that I've ever had has been the hot flashes. They've been that terrible. But I have not had, I mean, I've lost weight. I mean, I've lost weight.
So you're one of those people. Yeah.
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 So we just like to complain about the weight gain more. But if you can, so with aromatase inhibitors, what are the main names someone might hear? The name and then the generic?
Yeah. So the generics are anastrozole with its partner brand name is Arimidex. Letrozole is another generic and its partner brand name is Femara. And then exemestane is our last one and its brand name is Aromacin.
Perfect.
And those, I would say the vast majority of time women will get the generic of these pills now because they've been around for a long time and insurance covers them. But some women really do feel like they tolerate the medicine better if they're on the brand name. And so some people are still getting brand name drugs. So just depends.
Interesting. This is very powerful stuff. So, and I think something also that a lot of people don't realize that we were talking about earlier is that men take these.
Yeah, men can take these as well. So the majority of the information we have for male breast cancer is that most of the cases are hormone receptor positive or estrogen hormonally driven, let's say. And so tamoxifen will help with that. If you have a man who has, again, a really, really risky breast cancer, sometimes you can use aromatase inhibitors, but then you have to use the Lupron or the Zoladex again. So kind of think of male breast cancer a little bit more closely related to premenopausal breast cancer, regardless of the man's age. And so when you're trying to use aromatase inhibitors, you have to shut down their testicular function. And so that is a lot more like how they feel going through prostate cancer treatment, and a lot of side effects that way. But yeah, same drugs apply.
That's amazing. So let's say a patient is in the world where the physician is recommending aromatase inhibitor. We've discussed what the three of them are, the most common ones. Remind us again. So they need to be in menopausal status.
Yeah. So in order for an aromatase inhibitor to be effective, you want to make sure you have very, very low levels of estrogen to begin with in your body. So that's either knowing that you've been a year without a period, and then many times still having hormone levels from your blood to show that you're at an appropriate estrogen level to get an aromatase inhibitor, or physically shutting down the ovaries or taking them out. The trickiest group of patients to think about this in is those who have received chemo, because we know after chemotherapy, within about a year to 18 months, most women will get ovarian function back. You know, the closer you are to 50, the less likely that is to happen. But if you're in your 30s to early to mid 40s, odds are you're going to get ovarian function back. So knowing that, many times those patients will get tamoxifen to make sure that they're covered during this transition time, or we're going that whole ovarian shutdown approach to make sure that they're still covered.
So the shutdown approach is Lupron or Zoladex, or you can do permanent route, which is surgery. I don't know, is it oophorectomy? There's lingoparectomy. There's like different words.
So actually that's another thing that comes up that there's some confusion on, is that if you are, you know, removing bits and pieces of your body to help treat your breast cancer, really the only thing that needs to be removed is the ovaries themselves. And so that's the oophorectomy. In our world, a lot of women end up getting hysterectomies too, which is kind of a personal decision, just because they're like, well, if I'm going to have my ovaries out, I don't need my uterus, I might as well get rid of it as well. But you don't have to in order to appropriately treat your breast cancer. But that does bring up another point that I hadn't mentioned earlier with tamoxifen, which one of its most feared and rare complications is actually a risk of uterine cancer. So, you know, it's one in a few thousand women who will get that. Certainly less risky than the breast cancer recurrences that we're trying to prevent, but it's real. And so, you know, if you're on tamoxifen, you're having more period irregularity, like bleeding between periods, really, really heavy or longer lasting periods. Although this is mostly an issue with postmenopausal women who take tamoxifen, and that's kind of why we've moved away from it. And you have any bleeding, vaginal bleeding when you aren't having periods, that's a big concern. And we get you to a gynecologist right away.
Yep. Yeah. I actually had that. I remember I messaged you as well as my gynecologist, because in between periods, they were super heavy, and then it was just a lot. And I think you had shared that was a side effect of tamoxifen, where I think the lining had just built up so much. And I just essentially what I needed to have done was a DNC to go out and like scrape out the lining and perhaps reset my body. And ever since then, I've been fine with that. So as far as the surgical route, if someone does go for oophorectomy, that is really all that's needed in order to be on an aromatase inhibitor if they're still in menopause. I'm sorry, if they're still premenopause. Mm-hmm. But is there any advantage for them to keep the fallopian tubes, to keep the uterus, to keep all that? Or again, like how should they? Because that's a question that's been asked to me. Like, do I just have the ovaries? Or like you mentioned, while they're in there, dig it around, just take them all out.
Yeah, it's a great question. So for most women, taking the fallopian tubes is not that advantageous. The one group that's different there is really patients who have BRCA mutations, because they actually will have a risk not only of future ovarian cancers, but also cancers that develop in the fallopian tubes, which is kind of crazy. So they get their tubes and their ovaries removed. And then the uterus is one that's, I think, kind of polarizing. If you talk to gynecologists or urologists, a lot of times they'll say your uterus actually helps to kind of support the other organs in your pelvis. And so sometimes it's good to have it, because then you're less likely to have like bladder prolapse or pelvic floor muscle dysfunction. And so I think the more minimal surgery is often what's recommended by the gynecologist that I work with. But there are a lot of women who will say, you know, I have endometriosis, I have bad periods, I have fibroids, I have lots of other things that would make you think about taking the uterus out, and then they do it too.
Any other additional side effects that someone may experience on aromatase inhibitor than they would tamoxifen?
Yeah, so I think a couple big ones with aromatase inhibitors that people should know about, and the one I actually probably hear about the most, is joint aches and pains. So aromatase inhibitors cause this very particular joint stiffness, joint discomfort, where when you have been sitting for a period of time or inactive, as soon as you start moving, it's like you're the Tin Man from The Wizard of Oz, or like a little old lady. Yeah, exactly. And once you start moving, it feels better. But that can be tough. And especially for people who have more sedentary jobs, for example, and are like at a computer all day, they will often have to get up and walk around frequently just to keep their joints moving. There are some tips and tricks for that too. Anti-inflammatories help. Fish oil is a natural anti-inflammatory that can be really, really good for that kind of pain. And I've had some good luck with collagen for that, helping with the joints, also helping with hair and nails on endocrine therapy. And exercise, acupuncture, massage, all of those things that help support the joints in other ways, huge for managing that stiffness and pain. But if a woman is stopping endocrine therapy, it's usually their hot flashes or joint pain, honestly. And then the other big category is sexual health and sexual dysfunction. And on aromatase inhibitors, we tend to see a lot more vaginal dryness than with tamoxifen. Sometimes women on tamoxifen actually have like a vaginal discharge, which can be bothersome, but maybe better than the dryness. You can get dryness on tamoxifen too, but particularly with aromatase inhibitors. And, you know, sometimes it's just with sexual activity. Sometimes it's with exercise or wiping after you go to the bathroom. That whole dryness phenomenon or vaginal health with endocrine therapy can lead to frequent urinary tract infections and just fragility and, you know, tears and bleeding. So oftentimes that's something that I'm asking patients about because it can be a huge factor on quality of life, and they may not be inclined to bring it up with their doctor. So I think you should, because there's a lot of things that you can do with your gynecologist or even just on your own that can help with that, like vaginal moisturizers, for example. Like Replenz is a product that's available in the grocery store, pharmacy, over the counter, that can be really helpful for vaginal dryness.
Well, this is a great opportunity for us to give a little plug for some of our previous episodes, because we have had sexual health therapists and coaches and wellness doctors talk about all the many different ways you can moisturize your vagina.
That's great.
In the event that you're dried out. So on that note, no. I mean, this was incredible. Layla, I don't know if you have anything additional to add or comment, but I was sitting here taking lots of notes, stuff I can call my friend with right now and tell her about, but this was wonderful and definitely a topic that it was well needed for us, but also for many other women, because as you can see, this is a long conversation and sometimes physicians don't have the opportunity or patients to get into a long conversation to go through all the ins and outs and walk someone through. And so hopefully this podcast will be able to help out some other women and bring them value.
And men.
You're right.
And men. We love our men. We love our men too. But Dr. Cruz, thank you so much for being with us today. We really do appreciate your time. We're honored that you were here. And wow, amazing information. Going to be incredibly helpful. So thank you.
Oh, thank you so much. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to get it out there. And hopefully this stimulates more conversations with patients and their doctors about, you know, what they're really going through and what we might be able to do to help. And thank you to the both of you for opening the door for these honest conversations, because they need to be had. They're so important.
Thank you.
So Layla, oh my gosh. This is what I love about Dr. Cruz. Not only does she go she bases a lot of her decisions on like guidelines, as we call ASCO guidelines, American Society of Clinical Oncology, but also NCCN guidelines. Those are all the guidelines that oncologists follow. But she also offers advice and tips that are outside of that, that maybe are a little bit unconventional. Like for hot flashes, magnesium and vitamin E. I mean, girl, shit, if I was you, I would be dosing myself with that.
Well, if you dose yourself in way too much magnesium, like you won't need the toilet for 10, 15 days.
Oh, okay. Well, whatever. You've got the hot flashes.
But I did pull it back out. Oh, no. I pulled out the Natural Calm, right? That is fantastic. I started drinking that again. I didn't drink too much. Got to watch
the bowels. Natural Calm.
But it is rocking and rolling, and it does make a difference. And the other reason that Dr. Cruz is so amazing, it's not just her demeanor and her bedside manner and her expertise in these areas. She's okay with us cursing, and she doesn't mind a few curse words either. She's really real. Love that woman.
She is. She's really cool. I mean, it's, hopefully sometime if you ever come up here to Cleveland, you can get to meet her. She's truly a gem. And, I just appreciate how she has walked me through my journey with a very calm and nurturing and mindful ways in her approach. Yeah. Actually, just something else that came to my mind, how she said like fish oil and collagen, those are also good for hot flashes. And a side benefit, can be for your hair and nails. So I just think she's just excellent. And like, I go back to that story at the beginning, shame on me for saying, could I have someone that didn't just finish fellowship?
Hopefully some of the fellows. To everyone out there.
No, shame on me. So, but at any rate, I hope everyone really enjoyed this episode. And as always, we would love to hear comments, feedback, and more importantly, suggestions. What's on your mind? Actually, the way we got this recording came from a suggestion and a need of a dear friend of mine. So send all of that to us at info@breastcancerunleashed.com. Find us on our socials, like us, and if you feel it's appropriate, please share with your friends, family, and anyone you know that may be going through breast cancer.